Can psychedelics save us?
Isn't it interesting? At this point, where we're about to crush the planet, okay? We have these incredible plants, and maybe somehow they can help save us. They can say to people, wait, we're really important to you. You need us, plants. You need us, mushrooms. You need us. We need our fungal networks.
That's Joe Dolce, author of Modern Psychedelics, the Handbook for Mindful Exploration. Today, Dolce tells us why psychedelics are seeing a cultural and scientific resurgence, and what that can mean for society. This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, we explore what's going on with the current resurgence of psychedelics. My guest is Joe Dolce, whose new book, Modern Psychedelics, the Handbook for Mindful Exploration, dives deep into what these substances really do, why so many people are using them, and how science, politics, medicine, and culture are reshaping the conversation. He tells us why this is both an exciting and confusing time in psychedelic history, a time when reliable guidance is urgently needed in a moment of expanding access and misinformation. We talk about what psychedelics can help heal, from PTSD and addiction to depression and traumatic brain injury, why set and setting matter so deeply, how to microdose psychedelics, and how these substances can change not only individual consciousness, but maybe even how we relate to each other, to nature, and to the world we're trying to save. In addition to Modern Psychedelics, Joe Dolce is also the author of the 2016 book Brave New Weed, Adventures in the Uncharted World of Cannabis. When he's not writing about mind-altering substances, he's a communications coach for companies and individuals. Joe Dolce, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Francesca, so happy to be here with you.
I totally enjoyed this book, Modern Psychedelics, the Handbook for Mindful Exploration. This is not your first book about mind-altering substances. You also wrote Brave New Weed, which was about cannabis. What got you interested in this field?
Well, several things, actually. One, let's call them drugs, intersect so many areas of our lives, medicine, politics, policy, that I think it's an interesting way to look at what's going on. Number two, so many people use these substances. They're still illegal, mind shockingly enough. So we don't have any real guidance in some ways. I mean, cannabis, yes, it's legal, but what's happened with it, and I wrote this book before it was legal, but and what's happened with capitalism is sort of depressing in a way, in that it's just become all for profit. So there's a lot to look at when thinking about these substances. The other reason is, of course, is that, you know, so many people are using them. I mean, I remember when I started Brave New Weed, I thought, wow, all these people use cannabis, and there's really no book that's sort of giving them credit for it, in a way. and I thought they could use that. I thought it would be a good thing. I'm not sure if it was the case or not. And with psychedelics, look, we are in this limbo state of, I mean, they are illegal, but access is so open now. The fact that we're having this conversation is very different than it would have been 20 years ago. And there's still so much confusion and so much misinformation about what these are, how they work, why they work, who they don't work for, who should take them, who shouldn't take them. So I thought it was a good opportunity. And I think the other reason I came to write Modern Psychedelics is that I thought Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, is a great book. But it's sort of a tease. It tells you all these things that are possible with psychedelics, but it doesn't really guide you how to use them or talk to you about dosing or the risks for each one or how to set up a really good journey or a better journey. So I thought, okay, let's try that. See if people are interested.
Now, you started out, much as I did, with taking these substances. You did that with LSD and MDMA. I can remember my first acid trip, which I took in 1971, I believe, and I haven't taken that many, but I achieved Satori at the very first one. And I found it very interesting in your book to show that there are different experiences at different dose levels, and that kind of achieving Satori is on the higher level of it. I remember taking blotter acid, so I totally had that, and it was a life-changing experience.
How so? What made it life-changing?
Well, at the time, and I still am, I was very active in social justice issues. I was anti-war. I was very political. I was not spiritual. And that experience opened me up to the spiritual dimension that I realized was really at the basis of my political interests, because social justice activism is all about justice for everyone, right? And justice for all living beings. And the spiritual experience that I had is that we are all connected.
Yeah. It's a real part of the psychedelic experience, almost no matter what substance you're taking. You know, there's a thing called the mystical experience questionnaire that they give to people in studies. But when you look at it, I think it does a pretty good job of defining what a mystical experience is. Are you familiar with it?
I think you have it in your book.
I do. But some of the things are really interesting. And one of them is exactly what you said, this unitary consciousness that it blurs the boundaries between self and other or self and object. Here's a few others. There's a sense of the sacred, that you've met the source of all being. Some people call that God. A noetic quality, that the experience is imbued with a meaning that is true beyond question. A deep joy or blessedness, ecstasy or awe. And then an ineffability, which is that it's beyond words, and a paradox, that you can accept the coexistence of mutually existing states. It's both and, rather either or. And that is, I think, a pretty good basis of what most psychedelics give you, especially that both and thinking and that unitary consciousness. I had a similar thing. I wasn't quite as political as you, but boy, I can remember, I mean, I think I wrote about this. I remember I was at school in Chicago, and on acid, my first acid trip, we went to the Art Institute and we looked at Monet's painting. And I was never a fan of Impressionism, but I sort of fundamentally understood not so much the painting as the inspiration behind the painting.
Say more.
What drove this artist who was, you know, dead for 100 years to do this? And I still remember that. And I can still tell you that some of my early psychedelic experiences are very firmly etched into my mind, whatever mind is. They don't go away. So they are very profound and powerful experiences, you know, if you're so inclined.
Absolutely. I mean, indelible.
Indelible. And I'm so inclined. And I think what's interesting now, you know, many years later, is that the experiences do change with age.
You say that they've gotten, and I love this word, more resplendent with age.
I think they have. I mean, I use psychedelics much less now and much more judiciously. But I think because they're considered non-specific amplifiers, they amplify what is in the brain, in the mind, in consciousness. As you get older, there's just more of a repository.
Repository of experiences.
Of experience, yeah. So it's. I think it's quite interesting to use them at different points in life.
And you say as you grew older, you wanted to keep maintaining a flexible mind and a childlike awe. You call it an anti-classification plan. What do you mean by that?
Anti-ossification. Yeah. I think flexibility of both mind and body is really important as we get older, because I'm sure you and I both know lots of people who are super rigid. This is who I am. This is what I do. This is what I like and what I don't like. And I don't want to try that new thing. And I understand that. I mean, we become more habituated in life, because it's easier. There's less to think about. There's less to, you know, and energy is, I guess, diminished as we get older. I haven't quite gotten to that point yet. But I don't want to turn into my grandfather. I mean, the guy was just a rigid stone, not open to anything new, and extremely unhappy as a result of it. I don't want to be that guy. And most people I know don't want to be that guy, and I don't want to hang around with people like that. I want to hang around with people who are open and still able to see the beauty, the awe, the joy, as well as the dark in our lives, you know? I really do. I think these textures are they go on forever, and we can become very inured to them as life gets older, as we get older.
And Joe Dolce, in Modern Psychedelics, you say that it is now an exciting and confusing time in the world of psychedelics. What's most exciting and what's confusing?
I think what's exciting is more people are trying them and opening themselves to the experience. And I think we're seeing them with new eyes. Like when we were younger, we didn't know about the health possibilities of psychedelics. We didn't know that they treated depression, TBI, traumatic brain injury, PTSD, addiction. I mean, actually, to be honest, there were many, many studies about LSD in the 1950s and 60s that did point to these things, but they were so suppressed by the war on drugs. And I myself was influenced by the war on drugs. I'll never forget that ad of the egg cracking into a frying pan, bubbling up, crisping, and then the words came on that said, "This is your mind on drugs." I also believe at this point that we're starting to understand that psychedelics aren't like other drugs. Like in a pharmaceutical, it acts the same way on the same receptor every single time, producing a similar effect. That is not how psychedelics work. They are much more unpredictable and thus sometimes more interesting. And they're not addictive. Psychedelics aren't, you know, they don't cause that kind of dependency that an opioid might cause or other drugs of pleasure. So that's also quite interesting. What's confusing is, well, there's a few things confusing. First of all, we're in this funny time where access is growing. The government doesn't really seem to be tamping down on it. They seem to be allowing it to happen. And this is a policy that I believe Health and Human Services is quite aware of, but is not articulated to the public. We know it. Those of us who avail ourselves of these substances. And, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. Are they going to be legalized? Are they going to be decriminalized? If they are legalized, who should control them? Should it be Big Pharma? Should it be capitalism with a profit motive in everything? Should it be the medical profession? That would limit access, I think, to a large extent. Should it be the community of users, which is sort of where I'm thinking it maybe should lie? I mean, in a way, you know, the underground has actually done a pretty good job over the years of spreading knowledge, of holding people safely, of really understanding how these things work. I mean, you have to get into the community before you get there, before you understand all this, but I don't know. I'm thinking that maybe the underground has done a really good job and maybe there needs to be, how about some both and thinking? Sure, maybe there should be a medical track for people with serious illnesses, but maybe there should just be community centers where people can go and trip and you know, underground shamans or therapists, whatever, or guides can lead journeys as they have been doing for many decades. And I would say, my experience, pretty well. Once you know how to find a good guide and a good group of people, you're in pretty good hands, I would say.
Well, if you judge by the history of what's happened to the cannabis industry, it's probably going to be most likely the first two. It's going to be taken over by Big Pharma, and that's not necessarily going to be the best thing for it.
I don't think it is. I don't think Big Pharma loves psychedelics for one thing, not in their current state. I mean, they are trying currently to create all sorts of novel molecules. They're, you know, the trip is very inconvenient for Big Pharma. It takes a long time and many hours and in most instances, therapeutic intervention both before and after. This is not a model that Big Pharma likes. However, I think it's a model that the medical profession needs to really look at and provide for. So, for example, there's a lot of research, which I talk about in my book, about how these substances are working in the brain to really create healing. And what they have found is you have to prepare for the journey for, you know, not a few minutes, but hours, several sessions. You do your journey, which could be 6 to 8, 10 hours, 24 hours in the case of ibogaine. And then you do integration, which can be another 8 hours, maybe the rest of your life, not sure. So, you know, I can't see, the insurance world has to wake up to this as well. And I think it's possible because, look, let's face it, if you go in for a knee replacement, right, your physical therapy is part of the cost. It's part of your prescription. So you have this expensive operation, and then you get whatever, 10, 20 hours of PT afterwards. I think we can look at that. If you're going to use psychedelic medicine, we should have some number of hours baked in for preparation and integration. What do you think of that model?
let's kind of go back to some of these basics, because you've implied a number of different aspects of this, that all of which you really explore in depth in this book, Joe Dolce and Modern Psychedelics. You say psychedelics are drugs, but they don't act like pharmaceuticals. Now, you already said that that has to do with pharmaceuticals act on one specific
target.
You say there is a reason that there is cross-diagnostic efficacy. In other words, there are many different conditions. And in fact, in the case of one of the substances you talk about in the book, in peyote, it's a kind of panacea. It's been used by Native Americans for a whole range of different conditions. What is the biological basis for this kind of panoramic use?
That is the biggest question of the day, really. So some people think it's because they all work on a similar set of receptors, say serotonin. I don't quite buy that because my research and other people's, many other researchers have shown that, for example, ketamine or ibogaine do not work on serotonergic receptors. I don't want to get too into the neuroscience and biomechanics of this, but there is what's called a cross-diagnostic category. I mean, the cross-diagnostic thing that happens almost with all psychedelics, like they all have been shown to treat depression, TBI, PTSD, addiction. No other medicine does that, okay? So there are other theories of why this is happening, one of which has been articulated very beautifully by a researcher called Gould Dolan, who's now at Berkeley. And she says, what psychedelics are doing is, and this is on a molecular level, okay, a deep level that I am not in any way capable of explaining, but that they are opening what's called a critical period of learning. And these are very well known in science. Critical periods are periods when the brain is very open to a lot of input, and they're limited periods. And you can think about this. You can think about language learning as kids. So there's a critical period from, I don't know the ages exactly, from 2 to early teen, where kids can really absorb language. They can hear the different sounds of language and replicate them much more easily than we as adults can. Okay? And that is just a fact. That is a critical period of language learning. There are visual critical periods where, for example, if you're born with cataracts in your eyes and they are not removed by age 5, you will never see because the critical period of visual learning has closed. So the theory is that, and this is the interesting thing, is that psychedelics are able to open another critical period of learning temporarily, which is why the preparation is so important. It almost primes the brain in terms of what's going to happen in the trip. So you're Alice and you're in Wonderland and you're going through and you are seeing all of these different memories and images and stories. And somebody I just interviewed with Ibogaine was able to say, you know, I saw that terrible thing that happened and I was able to push it away. And then I saw that beautiful thing and I was able to bring it to my heart. And that is really interesting. So, and then what happens then is that the integration, the therapy, whatever you want to call it afterwards, helps solidify some of the things you learned and saw in the journey. And if you think of it that way, wow, what an opportunity to re-examine some of the things that may have really messed with your life, like especially in terms of abuse or addiction, which is a lot of stuff. It's not just physical, it's habit, it's images, it's so many things. And I think that one is really worth exploring and gives me great hope for the future of psychedelic medicine.
And also, what was new and interesting to me, I have read Michael Pollan's book in which he talks that, well, there's this default mode network in the brain, which is what you're kind of operating on all the time, just to kind of, you know, weed out things that would, you know, inputs that would make it too difficult for you to function. And then this critical learning period gets opened again. But to work on things like traumatic brain injury or early Alzheimer's, for example, those are physical things in the brain, and yet it seems to be able to help there as well. How does opening a critical period help to heal the brain in those ways?
I don't know. I don't know how to explain it. But there is a lot that's happening on the molecular level. There's so many brain functions and structures, the extracellular matrix, all sorts of things are happening, okay, in the brain that I don't really feel bright enough to explain to you because I'm not a neuroscientist and it is really deeply complicated stuff. So I'm giving you the top line here, but I can tell you I just interviewed on the Modern Psychedelic Substack, a football player called Robert Gallery, who has seen the holes in his brain from the traumatic brain injury and told me very explicitly that his rage has quieted, his suicidal ideation has all but disappeared. He has learned to reapproach his relationship. His marriage is now intact and working again. He was in really bad shape as a result of this stuff. So something is clearly happening. And he used Ibogaine. He went for 1, 2, 3 Ibogaine treatments in Mexico that was really able. He said it gave him his life back. And this is now, there's also a film called Wages and War. It's a documentary on Netflix that looks at the similar thing, traumatic brain injury in veterans. And they have had incredible success. And this is why, okay, here's another psychedelic fact for you. The red state of Texas has just given $50 million to research Ibogaine for traumatic brain injury and depression in vets. And they're looking for another $50 million matching grants, okay? That's Texas. So there is an interesting, weird shift happening. Want to talk about a confusing time in psychedelics? Where you have Republicans putting money, putting themselves on the line to say, we want to use these medicines to see if we can help heal our veterans, our football players. I don't think you need to be a veteran to qualify for healing, obviously, but you can see the political, let's call it the political appeal of that.
That's so interesting, especially in light of the decades and decades of attempts, well, centuries, to suppress these, everything from, you know, the conquistadores who forbade the use of psychedelic substances to, of course, the war on drugs, as you say. What is your thought? Why were governments, you know, or are governments so intent on suppressing these kinds of substances?
They're disruptors. And they make people question the norm. And governments like control. I mean, I'm sorry to say that, but they do. We're witnessing it every day. And these challenge that control. And they make people look at the things they're taught and told and hold, you know, hold sacred, if you will, differently. And the everything from the Catholic Church to, you know, the U.S. government to God knows every other government feels that's very threatening. And in fact, it is.
And yet the U.S. government, the CIA, actually was exploring some of these substances. It's so interesting because on the one hand, and I'd like to even talk about this more perhaps later if we don't fully explore it in this moment, you know, on the one hand, psychedelics, as you point out, it makes us, it's a disruptor. It makes us realize that we are all connected. And yet also was used as an instrument of, you know, of subversion, of not in a good way. By the CIA, there was a famous case of somebody who committed suicide who was given LSD without knowing, you know, again, he was totally unaware that he had been given a dose, and he dove through a window to his death. So talk about, you know, kind of the positive and the negative. How could the CIA use substances like this in order to do their dastardly deeds?
Well, what they were trying to do was, quote, soften people's brains so they could extract confessions out of them, right? And this was also in response to, I think it was the Russians or the Germans, or perhaps both of them, also using some of these medicines in the Second World War and post-Second World War. So they didn't want to fall behind, okay? But let's talk about this because it's really important. You know, I talked about the positive side of priming the brain, then the journey, then the integration. Well, there's a negative side too. And I think Charles Manson is the clearest example of this, right? He had a group of followers. He relentlessly, you know, told them that these were the enemies. These were the terrible people. We have to go kill them. He kept those people extremely high on LSD, probably on very large doses of LSD. And look what happened. Okay, so so context really matters here, Francesca. It really does matter. These substances are context dependent. And that's also a part of the Gould Olin's research that is very specific, is like, these are not magic pills. The context really matters. That's hard also for medicine.
Mm. Say more.
Maybe not so much for therapy, but for a doctor who's just going in to chop out something that's diseased, this requires a little more nuance. It's much more mind-body. It's not just body. So a lot of people are resistant to that. They don't think that that's real science. I happen to disagree. And I think many people who've used psychedelics and who are researching them now also disagree. When you look at how effective they are at, for example, addiction, right? Using them for addiction. We have nothing that treats addiction successfully. We have nothing that treats traumatic brain injury. We have nothing that treats PTSD. We have really nothing that treats what's called treatment-resistant depression. Psychedelics in the research are showing that these are effective, or at least as effective as, say, SSRIs. But the difference is they're not a pill a day for the rest of your life.
Yes, actually, you mentioned SSRIs. This is maybe a minor point, but a lot of people who are depressed are taking SSRIs. If they take these drugs, are there problems of interaction? I mean, there are some substances in your book that you talk about that you really can't take with SSRIs.
Yeah, well, some SSRIs inhibit the trip. So you'll have people who are taking them and they'll keep taking higher and higher in doses and don't get anywhere. Other SSRIs can combine and create something that's sort of called, it's called serotonin syndrome. It's quite a vague thing, okay? It can create heart palpitations and other unpleasant effects, really unpleasant effects. And you have to be a bit careful. You can't just, you know, not everyone should be taking psychedelics. I have to say this, okay? Let's be really clear. Like, if you are known to have bipolar disorder, high doses of psychedelics are really not recommended. Some people think, though, that microdosing psychedelics is acceptable with bipolar when you're on the, I always forget when you're on the up side of that, okay? But if you have like a history of serious mental illness in the family, they're learning that psychedelics may not be the best thing for you. It might be too disruptive to your mental state.
Joe Dolce, stay tuned for more of our conversation about modern psychedelics after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Let's get back to my conversation with Joe Dolce about his book, Modern Psychedelics, the Handbook for Mindful Exploration. So here we've talked about a number of things. We've talked about the setting. We've talked about, you know, your own particular susceptibilities or vulnerabilities because due to your own history or family history of mental illness, let's say. We've talked about, you know, some of the physical cautions. Give us a sense of what is the approach that people should take if they want to explore these. What are some of the things that they need to do to create the best conditions for them to take them? And what are some of the things that they need to think about to be cautious about their use?
Well, it depends, first of all, on what your experience with them is, I think. If you're just starting, it might be a very good idea to find a guide that you trust. And actually, in the book, I spent quite a bit of time talking to really smart people saying, okay, what are the qualities in a guide you should find? What should you look for? And some of those were great. Like one of them said, should have a sense of humor. Should not be too grandiose. You know, find out if you actually like the guide. Good. These are very good and very obvious points when stated. But, you know, if you're just starting out, it's easy to be hoodwinked by, and there's a lot of snake oil too. Not that much, but there are more, you know, as this thing grows, more and more people are claiming to be wise and great guides. So, but what they're saying is, look, before the journey, spend some time quietly. Journal, perhaps. Write. Think about what it is you're looking to explore. Turn off your damn screen. Turn off your news feed. That is not going to help if you're sensitive to the news. Some people restrict their diets. They sleep more ahead of time. They really do a serious preparation during the journey. Make sure you're, you know, we say set and setting as if everybody should knows it, but I myself, even though I've known these words for 40 years, have ignored them rather blithely and stupidly, I have to say. So, you know, if you're going to use music, you can find music that you really love or that you think, I mean, there's lots of interesting research about how to use music to help guide the journey, like starting quietly, then having it build to a certain crescendo with more action, and then having it come down a bit. I don't know if it has to be that complex, but I think you should figure out, you know, if you even like music during your journey. Again, with age, I actually love the sound of waves and wind and leaves rustling more than music. I find it more comforting. Make sure you're in a comfortable place. Make sure you're surrounded by people you love. Make sure you know the number of the Fireside Project, which is we'll call you in the middle of a journey if you want, even just to check in. And I think that's really good advice, good thing to know about. And they're a great org. After the journey, try to capture as much as you can. Try to capture the images, the thoughts, the paradoxes, the things that came into the journey with you. Some people write it down. Some people use their phone to record it. Some people draw, some people dance. It really depends on who you are and what are the things that have meaning for you. But the idea is to try to make some meaning out of it, right? Some people just like to talk to friends, talk to a shrink. Talk to your lovers. Talking through things can be very powerful. It all sounds rather obvious, but I think a lot of us don't. We don't honor the vulnerability that comes from the journey. So we step right back into the working day and wonder why it feels so hard to go to work. I like to think of it more as like a 3-day experience, not a 1-day experience. So you have at least some time before the journey to prepare, the journey day itself, and then at least 1 day after to reflect. And then the reflection really does go on for quite some time, especially if you're paying attention to that. And that's important, is to know, where are you putting your attention? What matters?
You know, it's interesting. I agree, of course, that it's important to create as positive a circumstance as you can. But one of my most striking experiences was the last time I took psilocybin. Now, this was a very long time ago, in the early 1980s. I was outside. I was in the country. I thought everything would be cool. I lay down in the grass, and I could feel the earth dying around me.
Oh.
It was the first time that I understood at the most visceral level what was happening to our planet at our hand. It was, to call it depressing, that's not even the word. I grieved. I really grieved. And I'm still grieving. But it was a very important experience because it was the one that opened me up to the true reality of what we were doing to our planet.
Yeah.
And it made me dedicate much of my work in activism towards trying to change that.
So here we have the both and paradox. This is a terrible, sad, depressing fact. And I am going to rise somehow to meet it head on as best I can, right? So it can happen. I mean, yeah, it's not all going to be pretty lights and pulsing walls, you know? As a matter of fact, I think that's sort of, in a way, I mean, I love that stuff, but in a way, it's sort of missing the point, right? Isn't it fascinating that somehow in your mind, that rose and had real meaning to you, which means that it was there. This isn't putting something in your mind that it wasn't there, right? Psychedelics are sort of uncovering, right? They allow an unfolding. Isn't that extraordinary?
Yes, it allows you to see the true reality, more real than real.
But isn't that extraordinary? What other medicine does it?
So, Joe Dolce, let's talk a little bit about these individual substances, because even though they all work in very much the same ways, there are differences. Tell us a little bit about MDMA. What is it good for? I know it's being used quite a bit in psychotherapy. But also talk about how long does it last? How long does that critical period open for? What determines that? Just give us some details.
Sure. So you're right. All psychedelics have different subjective effects. And MDMA is classified as an empathogen or an entactogen. So it is great at upping empathy, both for yourself and towards others. And interestingly, MDMA... You know, therapists came across MDMA in the 1970s after it was resynthesized, and they wanted to keep it secret. As a matter of fact, so secret they called it ADAM. They inverted all the letters, ADAM, and they were using it in couples therapy, and they were having unbelievable results because it enabled people to really say difficult things, and it enabled partners to hear difficult things with equanimity. You hear difficult things about yourself and really accept it and have great empathy for the person trying to tell you this as well. So the thought was, oh, wow, one session of MDMA, which by the way lasts about 6 hours, is the equivalent of 1 year in couples therapy. All right, and then it was banned. And then it went into the rave culture and became really the source of all things rave. And it became, I think, one of the great modern rituals, taking MDMA, going to a rave, dancing, feeling music, feeling connection with all the people around you. These are the things it's really useful for. So that's how that works. But then you can look at another one, say like this thing called 5-MeO-DMT, which comes from a frog found in the Sonoran Desert. It's only found in Texas, Arizona, and Mexico. And a fascinating substance. Well, first of all, I'll tell you how it's extracted first. You catch the frog. You squeeze the parotid gland on its back, out of which comes a venom that you dry, and then you smoke. Now, who figured that out? That's really one for the ages. No one has an answer to that one. But it is a very powerful substance, extremely powerful. In other words, you take one hit, and within 2 seconds, you are gone. You are gone very far away into another sphere. I don't have any words for it. It's extraordinary. It lasts for about 20 minutes, but that is a big 20 minutes. And it is a profound experience. It's called a near-death experience because the world is quite, it's not full of images. It's quite a white experience, really. And yet, I have to say this, I hope you believe me, it is one of the most beautiful things I've ever experienced. Absolutely beautiful, gorgeous. So that's very different, 20 minutes versus 6 hours. So ibogaine, okay, here's another one. This comes from a plant called Iboga tabernante in West Africa, basically in Gabon and Cameroon, two West African countries, with a very specific climactic region where this plant grows. It's used ceremonially. Usually, I think young men and young women are taking it, and they're having a very long journey. The journey can sometimes go on for days, and it's supported completely by the community. In the West, it's used as ibogaine. It's delivered in a pill. The journey can be between 12 and 24 hours, sometimes longer. There's a period following, which is called the gray period, which is when all the memories and all the things in the journey sort of consolidate in the mind. And again, it is known as the addiction interrupter because it stops addiction for some people after the first journey and also stops relapse. It is not always the case. I want to be very clear, okay? There are no miracles. I'll say it again. There are no miracles. But this is an extraordinary substance. It does have some interaction with the heart. So you have to have a lot of heart screening before you take it. And most of the centers that are now using it in Mexico, in particular, two that I know, are doing very thorough screening. They don't want any mishaps to happen there. You go to these centers, you're basically checking in for about 10 to 14 days because they want to make sure that you have integrated and are ready to face the world again after it. Now, some people have come back for more follow-up sessions with ibogaine, but it is still an extraordinary substance that we're really just learning about. We don't even know all of the receptors that it's working on when it's working. It's also subcategorized as an onirogen, a word I had never heard of until I wrote this book, something that creates a dream state when it's happening. It is not like an acid trip or a psilocybin trip. You're not seeing a lot of incredible images and fractals. It's more like I described earlier, like, oh, there's an image or there's a story that happened, a thing that happened to me. Do I want to keep it or do I put it away? Others have described it as seeing a slideshow or a video reel of your entire life. I haven't used it, so I don't have a direct experience of it, but it's a very powerful, very extraordinary substance that comes from a tree, a shrub that grows in the ground, which does have to make you ask at a certain point, why are these plants here?
Well, opine.
Don't know. I think they're here to show us things. I think they're here. Isn't it interesting at this point where we're about to crush the planet, okay? We have these incredible plants, and maybe somehow they can help save us. They can say to people, wait, we're really important to you. You need us, plants. You need us, mushrooms. You need us. We need our fungal networks.
This is exactly one of the things I wanted to go a little further into about, can these plants save the world? you know, of course, we've talked about set and setting being so important. So obviously you do have to prepare for them, etc. But you were really talking about why are they coming forth now?
So look at mushrooms, for example, and fungal networks, okay? They're extensive. They're really part of an entire of the forest, right? They're really a part of this very complex ecosystem. And once I started looking at it, I realized, wow, the mushrooms, the moss, the oxygen, the trees, the roots of the trees, all these things are connected and they are communicating with each other. And this is really hard science. This is not Joe being woo-woo, okay? They all communicate and they keep this ecosystem functioning and alive and thriving so that animals and birds and insects and everything works together, right? And the mushrooms, the mycelial networks are really important to that functioning and keeping it going. You know, if you look at ayahuasca, which is an admixture of two plants grown in the Amazon, let's ask ourselves, there are 80,000 plant species in the Amazon, somewhere between 40 to 80,000. I'm going on the high side here. How did a curandero in Peru know to mix this one and that one, boil them together for a number of hours, and then drink them, okay? And you know, science is saying, oh, they experimented with, but there's 80,000 plants. I don't think that's possible. And the shamans will say, the plants told us, and I believe they did. I believe that these people who are living intimately with plants, mushrooms, trees, have a completely different relationship to them and understand them more fundamentally that in a way that we in the West, with all of our technology, has managed to obliterate.
And there are many herbalists. I mean, forget even just these mushrooms. I remember once speaking to a medicine man of the Blackfoot tribe, and he told me that the plants would tell him what they were good for.
It's in a way you can't deny it because it has helped people for so long. And I think the number is 40% of all pharmaceuticals originate from plants grown in these ecosystems. So I think that's really important to think about. But, you know, that's why I love thinking about psychedelics because, you know, all right, there's ayahuasca, but then you realize the relationship that ayahuasca has to not only an ecosystem like a forest, but to an entire tribes of people. It was a healing method. It's a way of initiating people into a worldview that kept the tribe together, right? They didn't use laws to hold themselves together. They actually used plants as a way in, as a way to explain the ontology of the entire culture. It's pretty fascinating, huh?
Well, let's talk a little bit about access. You pointed out before that, you know, they're not legal, certainly on the federal level. Well, neither is cannabis on the federal level. They're in this kind of liminal place where they're neither one nor the other in terms of the law. I mean, they may be illegal, but it's not being enforced. You know, without getting too specific, because I'm sure there are different circumstances everywhere, are they available? And what are some of the resources that you recommend to people if they want to learn more about them outside of your wonderful book, Modern Psychedelics, The Handbook for Mindful Exploration?
I think they are available. And the way you get access is to plug into a community of like-minded people. And they're out there. And you can find them in Reddit forums. You can find them probably around the corner from you if you start talking about it. That was one of the interesting things. Okay, so I work as a consultant in a lot of corporations and startups. I'm a media trainer and a presentation coach. I help people to speak in public, give keynotes, do TED Talks. And I was very concerned at first that, oh, I'm writing a book on psychedelics. What are my clients going to think? And guess what my clients thought? That is really interesting, Joe. Oh, I did an ayahuasca journey yesterday. Oh, I've been thinking about doing a ceremony. Oh, let me tell you about my last trip with LSD. Oh, I'm just going on a retreat, a 5-MeO-DMT retreat. I mean, it's very out there. And I work a lot in technology with a lot of technology companies, and it's well known that people who are using technology love psychedelics. They use them a lot for quote unquote optimization. And we don't have a lot of research on this at the moment. They were not really funding studies to explore cognitive enhancement or creative inspiration or actually physical prowess. But from all the people I've spoken to, I know people who are microdosing with LSD or mushrooms, and now there's many other substances people are microdosing with, ibogaine or iboga or huachuma, San Pedro. But they're using them to increase their cognitive skills. They have better days. My own experiences with microdosing is I have more clarity, more focus, more motivation to get to my desk in the morning. I have sometimes better workouts. Some athletes claim they have much better workouts on them. It's not across the board. There's probably as many people who say microdosing is bunk that say it's fantastic. And the science is really interesting. So even this week, there were two studies released, both on LSD, microdosing LSD. One gave people LSD to take it home, and there was a 60% of the people said they had less depression, that it helped their depression. There was another study, a larger study, which claimed there was absolutely no difference between microdosing and placebo. And I've been doing it for about 5 years, microdosing. And for me, there's an absolute benefit to it and almost no downside. There is no downside. It's such a small, it's one-tenth of a standard dose of a substance that doesn't really harm you, right? So very little negative. I can't find the negative. I've been looking for the negative and looking for it, and I can't find it. It just feels, and that sounds, I know it sounds unreal, and it sounds unlikely, and that I've been literally drinking the Kool-Aid. Well, I have been, and I'm going to continue drinking the Kool-Aid because I really like it. It really works for me.
So microdosing, is this something you just do at home? You just take a little bit, or is it something that comes in pre-packaged preparations? How does it work?
Good question. It really depends. I mean, there's lots of ways of doing it, but what you're generally taking is one-tenth of a standard dose of either psilocybin or LSD. So you'll take, say you're using a blotter of LSD, you'll take the blotter, dilute it in 5 ounces of water, 10 tablespoons, and then you'll take between 1 and 1.5 tablespoons every 3 days. That's one protocol. You can take the same thing with psilocybin. There are different protocols with it. Some is blended with niacin to help reach outer areas of the body, the extremities, the feet, the hands, more quickly. Niacin increases blood flow. And they also mix it with certain adaptogenic mushrooms like chaga and lion's mane, which they also, there are studies that say this has a really great effect. And there's another protocol where you take it 4 days in a row, you're off for 3 days. Is that right? I may be mistaking that for protocol. It's in the book. I outline it very clearly in the book, the different protocols and how to use them. And mushrooms are a little more complicated because if you buy just a dried mushroom, you have to grind it, you have to encapsulate it, you have to measure it. It's a little harder to do. Of course, there are now services that supply these things. Your community can make you aware of them. People are using them. And now there are even, I met a microdosing coach the other day, and she creates a ritual for people. She blends her microdose with cacao and sends you a stick of Palo Santo and helps you create a ritual every morning when you're microdosing to make a little mixture of the cacao and the microdosing, light the incense, meditate for a few minutes, take your dose, stay calm, relax. It's not a bad way to start the day, I would say. Not a bad way.
Well, that's wonderful. And listeners, you can read all about it in Joe Dolce's book, Modern Psychedelics, the Handbook for Mindful Exploration. This has just been a terrifically fascinating interview. Thank you so much.
And I thank you for spending time with me and talking about this.
In addition to Modern Psychedelics, Joe Dolce is also the author of Brave New Weed, Adventures into the Uncharted World of Cannabis. Go to writersvoice.net for links to resources mentioned in our conversation. Well, listeners, we have just enough time left to read a poem by one of my favorite poets, Mary Oliver, a poem that seems apt to this ending time of year before we begin the new year. It's called In Blackwater Woods. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds. And every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this, the fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. That was Mary Oliver's In Blackwater Woods from American Primitive in New and Selected Poems, 1992. And one more thing. As we say goodbye to a difficult year, one marked by grievous threats to democracy, uncertainty, and relentless challenges, we also honor the quiet, steadfast courage that rose to meet it. Across the nation, ordinary people discovered extraordinary strength, standing up for neighbors under attack, defending democracy with their voices and their presence, and reminding one another that solidarity is a power forged in compassion. Again and again, communities chose love over hate, care over cruelty, and hope over despair. In their acts of courage, kindness, and collective resolve, they lit a path forward, showing us that even in our most dangerous times, we can answer darkness with a determined light. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.